Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by David Robertson and myself, Christopher Cotter. This podcast is produced in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and you can visit our website at www.religiousstudiesproject.com. So today I'm joined by Titus Yelm, who is a sociologist of religion working in University College London, and we're going to be talking about Marxist approaches to the study of religion, a subject of which I know absolutely nothing, so I will dive in by asking, first of all, what do we mean when we're talking about Marxist approaches? Where do Marxist approaches begin?
That's a good question. One of the reasons that should not be the only reason, but it is, I think, a pretty good reason to be interested in Marx, is that I think in current sociology of religion, he's massively under-applied or employed as a theoretical source of ideas. Partly, I think, that's because people who work on religion have a sense that Marx was singularly critical of religion, and that has kind of, and of course, the history of how Marxist ideas then were put into practice in socialist countries, that has not often given the sense that Marx and religion combine easily. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons. But I also think that, especially in the current climate, where I think inequalities and power relationships are imbalances in power relationships between different groups in society are quite prominent and quite visible as well, I think Marx really can offer us some insights. Mm-hmm. I think the main point about using Marx as a source, and when I say Marx, I'm not really talking about necessarily going back to just Marx, but Marxist ideas.
Okay.
and also developing those ideas. So I'm not an orthodox Marxist. Mm-hmm. My purpose is not to kind of read Marx right and say how he could be used in the study of religion. But I do think that the idea of power and ideology are interesting and very central to the study of religion, but like I said, massively underapplied at the moment, I think.
In order to get to modern applications and developments of Marxist theories of religion, I think we have to go right back and outline for the listeners where does it start? What's the core idea of Marxist approaches?
Well, the core idea of Marx, obviously, is the class struggle,
mm-hmm.
The proletariat against the capitalist. But actually, kind of my take on the issue is a combination of two things. My personal background actually is in kind of constructionist sociology. So I first started reading Peter Berger, who, especially in his personal views, is as far as from Marx as one can be. But if you read back to his old stuff, like the Social Construction of Reality, or even the Sacred Canopy, he does use Marx's ideas of alienation, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of the idea that language matters and we construct reality through language was where I started with. But I think Berger and Luckman's problem especially was that they didn't take these power issues into account, that all language isn't equal. Some words spoken by some people are have more power.
Mm-hmm.
And so through a kind of a process that I actually cannot even recall anymore, but I ended up I became interested in what's called critical discourse analysis, which basically draws on the kind of constructionist idea that reality is a linguistic achievement to a point, but it always is also rooted in the kind of the the real world, mm-hmm. the physical mm-hmm. universe, and also the social structures and positioning in society of people. So kind of my take on Marxist approaches to religion is actually a combination of kind of these constructionist ideas with Marxist ideas, and as such maybe not so very orthodox, as I said, mm-hmm. a very orthodox way of approaching kind of Marxist approaches to religion, but I do think it's a very helpful way of looking at things. How are kind of, you know, positions in society, legitimacy, for example, of religious groups or religious beliefs, how are they achieved discursively,
mm-hmm.
and how do kind of social structural positions affect those discursive struggles, if you will?
That's an interesting point, because that sort of discursive methodology derived from people like Foucault and Bourdieu is very popular. I mean, it's got a lot of currency in the social sciences at the moment. Very few of these scholars using that kind of approach would describe themselves as being Marxist or in a Marxist mm. tradition. Yet, with their concern on power and power relations, there does seem to be a lot of crossover. Is there a direct link between the Marxist approach and scholars like Foucault and Bourdieu?
Well, certainly for Bourdieu, but maybe less so with Foucault, because he personally didn't like the term ideology, for example, at okay. all. But Bourdieu certainly. My kind of problem, but I mean, I've read both, and I find both of them very helpful in some ways. And obviously, both have. I mean, Foucault kind of, you know, brought discourse to the very core of social scientific inquiry, at least for some people. And Bourdieu has you know combined that with kind of a novel way of looking at class distinctions, not just in terms of, you know, economic differences, but you know, taste and other
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But my kind of problem with both of these guys is that it's mostly a methodological problem, that when Foucault talks about discourse, it's a very diffuse term that doesn't really necessarily give you any pointers as to how empirically study discourse.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, people have been kind of developing his ideas since, but what I think where kind of critical discourse analysis, especially as kind of done by Norman Fairclough, the third element of that, there's the constructionism and there's the Marxism, but there's also an attention to linguistic detail, which I think is very powerful if you spend some time kind of getting to know some basic rhetorical moves and also, you know, structure of sentences and so on. And that's why I acknowledge my kind of indebtedness to Foucault, for example, but moving on from that to a more kind of combining linguistic analysis with kind of concern with power issues.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's emerging as a theme at the conference, we're recording this at Socrail, has been that this, it came up in what Tariq Madud was saying in his plenary and continuing about the issues, the changing relationship of issues of religion and ethnicity. That there seems to have been a shift over the last 10, 20 years of public issues being more about what were formerly maybe thought of as being racial have moved more into issues of religion.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is that we haven't seen much of that movement to do with class.
Indeed.
Does that mean then that Marxist critique of religion is impoverished, or is there a broader reason why we're not seeing these issues of class and religion so much?
Yes, and that is, you know, I mean, when I say there hasn't been interest, I mean, what I said about Marx's approaches and power being at the center, obviously power has been discussed quite a lot. I mean, there's the whole field of gender studies,
yeah.
It's all about power, ethnicity, race, it's really about power. But, like you said, class really hasn't... I mean, it was obviously big in the 60s and 70s. Uh-huh. But then they didn't talk about religion at all, because that, yeah. religion was supposed to be disappearing
yeah.
anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's these kind of interesting gaps that then class went out of fashion, and I think it's coming back. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing, and what I try to, what I'm trying to do, and some colleagues here, is to not only kind of redirect attention to both religion and class. Because my kind of concern is that even though we have some of the best class theorists in the world in the UK, I doubt that now that there's a kind of reemergence of interest in class, that they will bring religion with that.
Mm-hmm.
Or the other way around, that there's increasing interest in the study of religion, but necessarily not combining that with class.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's an important point. I think when we talk about power issues, I think we do need to keep our eyes open so the class doesn't become the only factor mm-hmm. that's interesting. But I think it should be there, because so many analyses that I've at this conference as well that I've heard when they're about religion and ethnicity, for example, and I'm just wondering if, you know, the analysis would include a class element, how different would it look, mm-hmm. and how much richer it would be.
Well, one of the things that I come across a lot in my research on I look at conspiracy theories in kind of yeah. new religious movements, and one of the issues that comes up again and again is this rejection of religion, of organized religion is the yeah. term they generally use, as a tool of oppression. If they had any religious terminology at all, it would be couched in terms of spirituality, for instance.
Yes.
So that is a Marxist critique, really, isn't it, that's going on in contemporary spirituality?
Hmm. Yes, in some senses, I guess. But I'm not sure how well it ties... I'm not sure how much concern there is in movements that call themselves spiritual rather than religious about capitalism.
Well, it's... They wouldn't call themselves religious or spiritual, but there is a clear spiritual drive behind things. I mean, you know, you get the more obviously political aspects, such as the, you know, the Occupy movement and things. Mm. But then involved with those, there are groups such as We Are Change and the Zeitgeist movement, who have a clear... there's a clear spiritual and moral kind of drive to what they're talking about mm. in terms of, creating freedom and enfranchising people and almost a sort of by pushing capitalism and the oppressive forces of organised religion away, that there's almost a new age kind of mm-hmm. Drive to it. Mm. So I wondered... Yeah, I just wondered what you thought of that and whether there was whether you could see a sort of Marxist aspect to that.
Possibly. I mean, you know, as sociologists of religion, we know that all kinds of combinations of yeah. ideas and beliefs are definitely possible. So, yes, possibly. But I do think that there's something to the original critique of religion as the opiate of the masses, mm-hmm. in the sense that, you know, if we look at work by what's his name? World Value Surveys and stuff like
okay,
that,
cool.
which quite conclusively, I think, show that, you know, the more welfare you have in terms of, you know, different aspects of welfare, obviously, but the better welfare you have, the less religion you have.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that goes back to the kind of Marxist original idea that, you know, if we only knew that we would kind of fight for our rights to a decent living in this world, we wouldn't have to worry so much about the next world. And possibly the worry about the next world is is taking our attention away from this world. And I, although, you know, I don't have a mission about preaching about against religion at all, but I do think that's an aspect that needs to be talked about, especially in this time when kind of concepts like post-secularity are tossed around quite freely.
Yeah.
I think there's an aversion in sociology, in a lot of sociology of religion, to kind of acknowledge the fact that possibly, you know, if people were just a little better off, they wouldn't, you know, care so much about religion.
And does that apply to academia as well? I mean, I'm wondering now if the reason that Marxist approaches became rather unpopular during the 80s and 90s was because it was a very wealthy time. And
That's possible, yes, yes. I mean, yeah, yeah. That's an empirical question, of course. You might say that, yeah.
Mm. So is there an identifiable kind of tradition then of Marxist scholars? I mean, obviously, you know, Marx and through people like Weber. And then is there an identifiable thread that leads through to we'll talk later about the sort of modern Marxist scholars and its place in the academy. Mm-hmm. But is there a thread that you can trace through the period where these kind of approaches were less popular, but maybe still these ideas were being used by scholars?
Hmm. Well, I mean, that depends whether we talk about Marxism in sociology in general or in sociology of religion in mm-hmm. particular. I think there's very little in sociology of religion to begin with. This might be, I mean, my view of this might be kind of limited by the fact that I'm obviously most familiar with the English language mm-hmm. area, so I do know that there are some German Marxist theorists and sociologists that have talked about religion, but if we stick to the kind of Anglo-American academia, I think it's difficult to kind of trace that kind of, you know, genealogy of Marxist approaches, because there isn't a consistent
okay.
kind of strain coming down from all the way from Marx. And also there's a difference between kind of Marxist theorists. I mean, you know, people mention Antonio Gramsci, for example, mm-hmm. quite often, and for a reason, you know, but he wasn't exactly a sociologist in the sense that we would talk about sociologists nowadays. And the thing was that when Marxists, like I said before, like when Marxists' approaches became popular in academia and in sociology, specifically in Europe, that was the same time when everybody thought basically that religion is going to disappear. So that connection never quite happened.
Mm-hmm.
And surprisingly, because the belief was so strong that Marxist sociologists didn't even think that they would have to critique religion in any particular sense, because, you know, it would disappear anyway. And I think, I mean, that's a historical kind of a conjunction.
Mm-hmm.
But now, when it seems that religion is not exactly disappearing completely, at least if it's changing its form, and class differences are not disappearing, I think the combination of the two is more urgent than possibly ever before.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the secularization thesis is kind of, as you said, it was very entrenched for a good 20 years, but in the last 10 years, it's become clear that we were, you know, it was at least highly inaccurate, if not completely wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I actually tend to kind of, you know, support some version of the secularization thesis, at least in the context of Western Europe. But that's exactly how it should be used in a particular context.
Mm.
Some of the claims were possibly a bit over the top, claiming that it's a global phenomenon. But I do think there's no reason to abandon secularization theory. I think it's very valid in the context of Western Europe, especially. And it will be very interesting to see how things develop in developing countries. What will be the role of religion after, say, China is an interesting place.
Yeah.
You know, for example, we couldn't really say what the future was.
And presumably Marx saw that when the proletariat had overthrown the bourgeoisie, that that religion would disappear. If it was a tool of the oppression, that when the revolution came, it would be a secular state. Is that the case?
Well, you could argue that. But he also kind of postulated this proletariat consciousness, which in empirically speaking never quite happened.
Mm.
And that's why religion had to be forcefully removed in the Soviet Union, uh-huh. for example. It didn't disappear by itself. Actually, Stalin had to struggle with the fact that it seemed to be, you know, growing in times of crisis, which was most of the time when Stalin was in power. And then he actually also saw the benefits of religion with the when the Second World War started, like in rallying people behind, you know, Mother Russia, which became almost like a religious object in itself.
So the
problem with kind of class consciousness is definitely something that hasn't quite happened, and that Marxist theorists have struggled with ever since. And you know, history shows us that socialist communist societies have almost inevitably become repressive regimes because, you know, people actually aren't thinking like the party likes to think should be thinking. Uh-huh. So there's a bit of a problem with the theory there.
And Mao obviously would be a very good example of a repressive kind of communist state, really marshalling that religious iconography and creating almost a state religion.
Yeah.
Bit of a tangent, but it just reminded me when you were talking about the way that some of the communist states sort of marshalled religion for their own benefit, was that in the 70s, at least, and into the 80s even, some of the religious studies, comparative religion courses in Britain, used dialectical materialism as an example of a religion in a Durkheimian kind of fashion. I mean, there was units, the Open University religion degree had a unit on dialectical materialism. Mm. Just what are your thoughts on that? I mean, it's fallen away now. You don't see that so
much. Well, I mean, yes, you could say that. I mean, from a functional point of view, a functionalist point of view, I mean, that's one of the discussions going on here at a session that I just chaired was the, atheism, non-religion, secularism, is that a religion? Well, I mean, there are functional similarities between some, you know, strong atheist groups and some religious groups, but I don't think they should be conflated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same with dialectical materialism. Yes, I mean, obviously, communist socialist states have had quite a few kind of ritualistic elements that could be functionally compared to religious rituals and whatnot. But I don't think that's a very fruitful way of approaching things. I mean, like Marx, Durkheim has given us some good ideas, but not all of them have been applied very wisely, I think.
Yeah. I just think there's a great irony about one of the staunchest critics of religion's function then being used as a functional, you know, his ideas being used as a functional comparison to religion.
Yes.
But
I mean, there was, of course, there was quite active attempts in Russia, in the Soviet Union, and in some of the satellite countries like Eastern Germany specifically, to re-educate people. So people were supposed to be re-educated away from religion and into a scientific, secular worldview. And in East Germany, it looks like at least it succeeded quite well because even though after the fall of the wall, people didn't really return to religion in any massive sense of the word. So it was part of the kind of empirical governments of that applied Marxist theory to re-educate their people, but whether that means that dialectical materialism is a religion is, a different question still.
Do you know what the status of kind of Marxist scholarship is in these former Soviet states? I mean, as you said, East Germany and thinking Soviet Union as well. Did they have a stronger tradition? Did the tradition continue unbroken in these states?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I teach at the School of Slavonic and East European Studies, so I should know, but they don't.
Yeah.
My sense is that there was a quite serious kind of turning away from the orthodoxy, because obviously, you know, especially in countries which were, you know, more strictly controlled, the academia could really only do orthodox science,
yeah,
and orthodox science was pretty much, you know, dictated by what Marx and Engels said. Even natural science. I mean, Engels wrote a highly problematic natural science book in his last years, which was even then known as highly problematic and mistaken in many ways, but that was taken as the norm, that this is the kind of good science that needs to be done in communist societies. So I think Marx and some others, kind of the Marxist theory was largely abandoned, but I also think that some of that remained, and Germans especially, I think, whether it happens more in East Germany or western parts of Germany nowadays, but I've heard the term that Marx is flying off the shelves there right now.
Right.
What the impact of that will be in the future, I'm not sure, but I don't think that Marxism is a big intellectual movement currently in the post-communist world.
We're running out of time, but then a brief closing thought then. Can you then position where Marxism is in the academy now? Are we? Is it something of a renaissance going on, or is it still a relatively unpopular, unfashionable idea?
Well, obviously, I would hope that there's a renaissance going on. It would be nice to talk to some people. But I think there's a reluctance by many scholars to identify as Marxist. I mean, I don't go around touting that I'm a Marxist necessarily.
Yeah.
Not that I would mind the moniker, but I don't think it's a major... I don't think there has been a major return to Marx, but I do think that anyone, regardless of their kind of theoretical preferences or whatever, can see that, you know, perhaps we should really pay attention to class differences, because they are so visibly, especially I think in this society, coming from Finland, it's maybe there's even more blindness to kind of class differences,
yeah.
Because there isn't the historical baggage, and also there is, you know, it is more equal and more equal society in many ways, but being an outsider in this country, you really pay attention to these things, and you see it all around you. I mean, just when you cross the street to another neighborhood, it's a whole another class situation,
yeah.
And it's very tangible.
Yeah, that's a perfect place to end. Thank you very much, Titus.
Thank you.
You've just been listening to David speaking with Titus Helm at this year's Socrel Conference at the University of Chester back in March. Next week, it's another interview with David, and this time he's speaking with Marion Bowman of the Open University on the topic of vernacular religion. And this is the first of a number of interviews that we recorded at the Religion and Society Programme's Sacred Practices of Everyday Life Conference back at the start of May in Edinburgh. And we were delighted to be invited to attend that on behalf of the Religious Studies Project. As ever, we'll be publishing responses to this. We've got Opportunities Digest coming up later in the week as well. We've just passed our 400th like on Facebook. So that's over 400 people are keeping up with everything that we're doing through that medium. We've also got our Twitter feed at ProjectRS. You can check us out there. And do remember that you can add comments and things on both of these mediums and onto the website itself. You can download this podcast and future and past podcasts through iTunes, and if you leave us a rating there, even if you don't use iTunes, if you just go to the website and give us a rating, that would be lovely. But for now, we hope you download again next week, and thanks very much for listening.